Welcome everyone to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, your host. And today we're joined by Becky Berger from, I would say, Willamette Valley, but Willamette Valley, Oregon. Becky, why don't you explain for our audience out there exactly where your farm operation is located at?
Well, we're pretty spread out. So we go from Hillsborough to Amity. We farm in three counties. So our Hillsborough location is probably 15 miles west of Portland. And then we just travel south from here and have different farms along the way and a seed processing plant in Carlton, Oregon, which is wine country if people ever travel to Oregon.
It's good to have somebody from the West Coast area, and most of my podcasts have been more, I would say, probably more Midwest focused, but I have had some from the Pennsylvania area. So now I'm starting to get a little bit of West Coast flavor. And of course, you know, I'm from the state of Washington, lived in Central Oregon for about 9 years. So I'm very familiar with your area, but I think a lot of the listeners to the podcast maybe have never been out to, you know, that part of the country and don't realize how much agriculture there really is in the Willamette Valley.
There is. I think Oregon has unique weather that allows us to grow many different crops in Oregon successfully. We have wet falls and pretty mild winters and wet springs and very dry summers with very low humidity. So it allows us to grow. The main crop that we grow is grass seed. And it's very successful growing weather for grass seed. Which needs no humidity in the summer. And so Oregon's the biggest producer of grass seed in the United States and of cool season grasses in the world. So
now when you say grass seed, is there just one variety of grass seed or is there multiple varieties of grass seed that you guys grow?
There's multiple varieties of grass seed. We have stuck with turf type tall fescue is the only grass seed that we grow. And we like that, but there's perennial ryegrass, there's fine fescue, there's annual ryegrass. There's several different types of grass seed that are grown in Oregon.
Okay. And then you mentioned that you have a seed plant. So again, maybe for our listeners out there, because I think this is a pretty unique operation compared to, let's say, raising corn and soybeans in Iowa or Illinois. So when you harvest the grass, well, let's step back. How do you harvest the grass, and then how do you process the grass?
Okay, yeah, I'll do a little history here because most farmers in Oregon, when they grow grass seed, they grow for seed companies. So Scotts or Pennington would come to a grower and they would say, hey, we want you to grow 150 acres of this variety or 200 acres of that variety or 25 acres of this variety. And that's how most seed is grown in Oregon from the local farmers. And then there are seed processing plants. First, when we go to harvest the grass seed, we usually around the 1st of July for tall fescue anyway, we cut the grass with swathers and we do it at night. So when the humidity dust, the dew does set on, and that's to keep the seed from shattering out of the plant. And so they swath all evening long. And then you wait about a week or so for it to dry and then you combine it. And then we truck it to a seed processing plant. Most seed growers do not have a processing plant. They would take it to another processing plant. And we do clean the seed of other farmers as well. And then there's a process where it is fed through a lot of different machines and you clean out any kind of weeds. You try to clean out the weeds or the chaff and then bag it and store it in your warehouse for shipping.
Okay. And I assume that some of that grass is stored a fairly long time before it's shipped out, or is it based on what the customer really wants or really needs?
Well, That's a good question. But it's right now, it's flying out the door. Grass seed is short.
Yep.
The price is, I've never seen prices like this. As soon as it's cleaned and tested, it's shipping out the door. But typically, you would get the seed in the fall, and it would ship out by May of the following year. And typically, companies pay you 30 days after it ships out of the warehouse.
Okay.
Now, I was a member of the Oregon Grass Seed Bargaining Association, who in 2011, we legislated a new law in Oregon where grass seed companies had to pay the farmers no later than May 1 after the year that the seed was grown. And before, seed companies could get sloppy with that. And if they didn't make their sales or whatever, the farmers would get paid even later. So that really changed the dynamics of the grass seed industry in Oregon. And seed companies were much more responsible with the acres they planted. And there wasn't, we have not had the overproduction issues that we used to have with grass seed.
Yeah, it's like, I think anything when you're dealing with specialty crops, maybe even more so than with commodity crops, it's very easy to get an imbalance of supply and demand. You know, the key is to try to, you know, keep that supply about equal to demand. I mean, right now, like you say, along with a lot of other ag products, we have a lot of demand and it's pushing up that price, but eventually it'll come into equilibrium at some point. So now I know that before, offline, we were sort of discussing the fact that certainly in my area, we've had a drought. In your area, you certainly were drier this summer, or maybe spring and summer. Did it end up affecting the yields, or did the yields actually end up being okay?
It absolutely affected the yields. We're down as much as 40 to 50% on our grass seed yields. Some tall fescue, there's about 30% that's irrigated in Oregon. There's about 60% of perennial that's irrigated in Oregon. So those did better. But the spring was historic. We've never had such a dry spring on record in the 150 years. So that hurt quite a bit. And then in June, we had three hot days where it was 115 degrees.
Yep.
Extremely unusual, which helped shatter some of the seed out of the plant prior to harvest. And so consequently, we were down quite a bit. And then grass seed sales have been extraordinary with COVID. So we've got a high demand and a low supply. And like I said, I've never seen prices like this before.
Yeah. So if you're a farmer, you want that situation, but you want to have a normal crop. So, you know, there's sort of a, if you don't have a normal crop, you're back to maybe being where you would be in a normal year. You just never know. And of course, I'm just curious, because, you know, with the normal commodity crops, wheat, corn, soybeans, there's certainly revenue protection insurance. I know there's whole farm insurance, which might cover a grass seed, but is there a regular revenue protection policy for grass seed?
There was an experimental program in Minnesota, as they grow some perennial ryegrass, and then they made that a permanent program, and then they're trying to adopt that. And I think that's now allowable in Oregon. But we have usually, I mean, we don't have crop failures in Oregon. This last year was just incredible. So I don't think anybody had taken advantage of that. So I haven't dug into it too much, because that's really not ever been a challenge.
Right, right. Well, and you know, you spoke of the spring. I know at my house, because I'm a little bit more up in the mountain area. I'm about 2,000 feet of elevation, and then I'm about 15 miles away from a little ski resort. And first part of February of this year, we got 3 inches of rain over about a 24-hour period. It didn't rain hard. It just rained constantly over about a 24-hour period. And we thought, man, this is going to be perfect weather. You know, we get the rain. And then, like you said, it stopped. You know, we didn't get any more rain until just about a month and a half ago. So, and I think your part of the woods was very, very similar.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, because our wheat, even though it went through the same very dry spring, our wheat did pretty well around here. It was still 130 to 150 bushel. So that did a little better with the dry weather, but the grass seed was certainly hurt very bad. So.
And, you know, for people in the Midwest, you know, a lot of times they're thinking wheat yields are like 30 to 50 bushels or 70 bushels. A great yield is 100. You certainly in your neck of the woods, in our neck of the woods, you know, 130 to 150 is very, very common. Matter of fact, a year ago, we had some 170s. So, and that's on dry land, but it is a soft white. It's not a hard red. It's not a soft red. It is a soft white variety. Well, I've talked enough probably about, you know, grass seed farming. You know, now, you know, typically when I'm doing a podcast, we're actually talking about your farm operation. So let's just back up and find out, you know, how long have you been farming? Maybe your family, how long they've been farming, and let's just go through the history of your farm.
Well, this is kind of a unique situation because I married into the farm. I married my husband, I hate to say it, about 45 years ago, and he was, he took over the farm at a pretty young age. He was 24 when we got married, and that's about when they handed over the books to him, and then his father really stepped away from the farming. He was there always for advice, but he really retired pretty much at when my husband was age 24. And his father was still a partner in the business, although not very active. And then he had a younger brother that he farmed with also. And so they had a partnership. And I started helping my husband pretty early on. I would go to accounting meetings and lawyer meetings and help him with the books and stuff. And he became ill and he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and just became over the years became more and more ill. And I became a partner in 1994 and then he passed away. And my father-in-law passed away, and then my husband passed away, and then I bought out my brother-in-law.
Okay.
So that's my personal history with the farm, which is a little unusual to have the daughter-in-law end up owning the business, but that was the best thing for the success of the business. And so my children are sixth generation farmers, and I have a son that's been passionate about the farming. He's been working, he's 41 and he's been working ever since he's 18 full-time in the on the farm. And then I've had two other sons that have worked off and on over the years on the farm. So
okay, now looking back on it, I think we always view things that maybe we did right, and we also view things that maybe we did wrong, you know, throughout our farming career. Is there anything that strikes you as maybe, hey, this is something I did really good, or something I wish I hadn't done that?
Well, one thing that that I did a while ago is that we bought some of our own proprietary varieties of grass seed. And so instead of growing for grass seed companies, which we still do, we bought some of our own varieties and started growing that and putting that out with other farmers. And that was a really good decision. Yeah. And that's, I'll tell you right now, for contracted grass seed last year for tall fescue was 80 cents a pound. Contracted grass seed for tall fescue this year is $1.25 a pound, which is, we've never seen prices like that for contracted seed. It's always been under a dollar.
Right.
And then our open market seed selling for $1.85 right now.
Oh, okay.
So that's a huge advantage.
Yep.
So it's been a really good thing. It's really opened up my world as far as we sell a fair amount into China. We started selling last year into Europe. I've visited China twice and met with buyers, and it's been, it really opened my personal world, but really opened up some opportunities for our business. And so that's something that's been done right, I'd say.
Okay.
Another thing I think we've done right is we started a family council, and we have a family business consultant that comes in twice a year, and we sit down with the family. It's with my children, any spouses of the children. Some family councils do not include spouses, but we decided to do that.
Yep.
And we meet twice a year, and we talk through business and personal items and that can affect business and affect the family. And I think that has been a real plus. A lot more transparency in this generation than we had prior.
Yep. Yep.
So we opportunities to sit down and talk about things, have somebody facilitate that, sometimes start those difficult conversations, but yep. We've had an opportunity to share the values that I certainly have as far as continuing the business, the kids all being supportive about that. And, that's been a really great thing. And I think it makes our business stronger.
Well, I know I've heard, sort of that older generation, not even necessarily our generation, but the generation before. Now, for a lot of people listening, they consider you and I to be old. I know that. But for the older generation, they would tell their kids, hey, you're going to hear about my estate plan, but it's going to be after I'm dead. So that was the extent of the conversation. Whereas, like you say, with the newer generation, and I think it's good. They want to understand, okay, mom and dad, what are your plans? We may or may not disagree with the plans, but at least we know what the plans are, and then we can deal with it accordingly, versus, just keeping everybody in the dark, and then you shine the light of day on it after you passed away. That's really not a very effective way of transitioning both a family and a family business.
Absolutely. I think in those situations, a lot of times the kids can start having relationship issues. But if you discuss that beforehand, get everything out in the open, this is mom's decision, then we can talk through those situations. And it might not always be the way they want it to be, but it's certainly not their brother's fault or their sister's fault. I'm blessed that my kids all get along really well. We've been through some tough times when dad was sick and other business problems, and it's really brought us together, and everybody's very supportive of each other. I just feel very fortunate. Now, will that always be that way? If I'm the glue, will it always be that way? I can't promise that, but we're really working hard to do our best to ensure that. So.
Right. Yeah. The key is you do your best. And if it falls apart, it wasn't because you didn't make the effort to make sure it succeeded. So now you had mentioned that you had a independent third party help lead that. Has it always been that way? And why did you do it that way or continue to do it that way?
Well, I did it that way because I found somebody that I have a lot of respect for, who's helped a lot of families that have had severe difficulties and have really helped turn around those situations. And we've not been in that position, but we were in that position before with my brother-in-law. So my husband and my brother-in-law probably never really got along, which is a good lesson for parents that if your siblings are not getting along in life, they're probably not going to get along in business.
Yep.
Right. And yep. So there were a lot of relationship issues in my generation with my husband and his brother. And it could have destroyed our business.
Yeah.
And in fact, we wouldn't be standing today if I was not able to buy him out. And I'm just saying we had different philosophies. We were paralyzed for quite a few years because we just couldn't move forward together.
Yep.
And a business will die. And if you're not working together towards the same goals.
I think that's an important lesson. I know sometimes when I get involved in family transitions, you know, that the family, it seems like their goal is we want to keep the business together. And after you get involved and understand, you know, the relationships both with maybe mom and dad and then the sons or the daughters or the sons and daughters, you find out the best thing for the family is to have the kids split apart and each do their own thing. And you know, I think a lot of times once they find out that's the best thing and they actually do it, it's by far the best thing that ever happened to that family, both from a family relationship standpoint and then from a family business standpoint. So I think that's a good thing to understand.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that's why I think having someone that's experienced and really gifted at what they do outside the family coming in was really beneficial for us. And yeah. And I do use advisors for a lot of different things. I mean, I wasn't born a farmer. I didn't grow up in a farming family. I didn't have a business degree. I was in the health field. So I have a business advisor. I have a trusted attorney that's a mentor to me. I really look to advisors to help me figure out the best direction for our business. So
okay, good, good. Well, Becky, we're going to go ahead and take a quick break for a sponsor message, and then we'll come back and continue the conversation.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm your host, Paul Niefer, and again, we're joined by Becky Berger from, I'm going to call it Willamette Valley of northwestern Oregon. It's essentially just west and south of Portland, Oregon. And Becky, we were talking about the farming operation, but I also would like to talk to you maybe a little bit about the accounting side of it, you know, being a CPA and so on, that accounting, I think some farmers view accounting as sort of the necessary evil, but I think if you understand accounting and use accounting, it can actually be a management tool. So let's just go through, what type of systems do you use for your accounting?
Well, we use QuickBooks, and we do inventory accounting, which was different than we had done before. My business advisor had strongly suggested that, so we could determine really the cost of what it cost us to grow a pound of grass seed and what it would cost us to produce, you know, a bushel of wheat or whatever. Yep. So we've been doing that. It has been a lot more work. We are very detailed in our QuickBooks as far as, you know, if we have contract labor, what's that contract labor working on? We document that. What chemical, what crop is that chemical used on? And as far as, is that a first year hazelnut field that was used on or producing hazelnut field? We're pretty detailed in our inputting. But then I think what we get out is better as well.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned hazelnuts. So that's also a crop that really in the United States is what, 99% plus or minus of the hazelnuts are grown probably within about 75 miles of where you live?
That's correct. Right. Hazelnuts are grown primarily in Oregon. And it's been a very popular crop here. The inputs can be cut back if the price is down, and the price has been pretty decent. It's cost quite a bit to establish the crop, but the return can be pretty impressive. So yeah. Yeah. So we just, after I bought my brother-in-law out, which was 6 years ago, we've done diversifying into the hazelnuts. And they're just now starting to really, the income is noticeable now. But right. It's quite a few years of, you know, a lot of money going into it. And so it's
waiting for that
it's
return.
Been a different type of farming. Yeah. It's but you know, being diversified is important as well. I mean, when I first married into this family, they did primarily wheat and crimson clover. And then my husband really got involved with grass seed. And so then we really got into grass seed. But, you know, having all your eggs in one basket is
yeah.
risky.
It can be right. And that's a key word, risky, which means when times are great, it's wonderful. But when times are bad, it's not wonderful. So that's, right. you know, like you say, diversifying, having multiple crops and so on, having your seed business, all of that helps, you know, with when if one crop is not doing very well, hopefully another crop is at least doing a little bit better.
Right.
Now, on succession, it was interesting how you did marry into a farm family that was the fifth generation, I think is what you're saying. Your husband would have been the fifth generation. You ended up transitioning, buying out your brother. Now you have one son that's been there since age 18, and I guess that's about 23 years now. What's your plans for transitioning to that next generation? Is it real formal yet, or are you still working on that? I'm just curious how your transition plans are for going to the next generation.
Well, after my husband passed away and I inherited some assets there, we started doing estate planning right after that. And I was meeting with the estate attorney probably once a month for quite a while. I mean, maybe 2 years.
Okay.
Just kind of trying to tweak. And, you know, and that kind of a plan was, well, what happens if something, you know, if I would get hit by the beer truck is what my family advisors called it. But, you know, it was just kind of like emergency planning and, you know, got some life insurance in place and, you know, made sure that my farming son would get 51% of control of all the companies because we have different companies.
Yep.
And so we got those in place, but we continue to update and tweak. I guess one of the challenges is that a lot of the family assets are in farmland, and it wouldn't be fair to give my farming son all the farmland because
right.
the other kids wouldn't end up with too much. Well,
yep.
I'm still working on ways to generate cash. We have some ways we're working on that, but so we'll probably still have corporate stock and different things that the kids will receive. So
like you say, I think sometimes when I talk to farmers and they think of an estate plan, they think it's just the document. And then as soon as you get the document, you can sort of stick that document in the desk drawer and, you know, look at it maybe once every 10 years and dust it off. Really, like in your situation, especially, you know, it is an ongoing process. It is not something that you can just stop and say, hey, we've done it. We don't have to worry about it anymore. So it's something that just keeps evolving.
So true. I mean, things change all the time. So, I mean, I know with my in-laws, that's pretty much the way it was done, that they had a succession plan way early. And my sister-in-laws did not even know they owned stock until my father-in-law passed away.
Yeah.
And they owned stock for many, many years. So that's where the transparency is good to have. And right now I pretty much own everything, and I need to start figuring out the right way to start passing things down. But
yeah,
I guess I haven't had, only had control really for 6 years here. So, yeah, I got to start figuring out how to let go of that. So.
You know, it's something, you know, us farmers, you know, I consider myself a little bit of a farmer. I mean, I got, I think 800 acres of farmland now. you know, we just have a hard time letting go of that control. And how come, you know, because you mentioned it when you're talking with your estate advisor, they were saying, well, what happens if you get hit by a beer truck? Every time I've heard an estate advisor say that, it's always a beer truck. Why isn't it some other type of truck? It's always the beer truck. I don't know why that is.
I just keep hearing that over and over again, so I just use it. But yeah. No, that's true.
Now,
who knows around here?
Yeah. Now, again, we're talking about succession planning, and because I am a CPA, and I spoke on it this morning to the Michigan Society of Accountants. I discussed the Biden tax proposals, the House Ways and Means proposal. I discussed it earlier this week in Seattle on Monday. You kept up with some of those proposals? Is there anything that you don't like or do like about the proposals? I'm just curious. And again, you're not a formal tax person, but I have a feeling you probably at least know about some of them.
Well, yes, I don't like the exemptions going down or proposed exemptions dropping. Yeah. That's not a good deal. I mean, Paul, I don't know. I'm so frustrated with all this tax and regulations. And Oregon's kind of out of control.
Yeah.
We've got this corporate tax that you tax. Yeah. They tax you on gross receipts.
Yep.
I spend probably more on accounting for that than I do on actually paying the tax. But it's ridiculous to be paying a tax on gross receipts. Anyway, I'm getting off track here. But I have a lot of concerns about this taxing the so-called rich. I just want this farm to continue on into next generation and the following generation. And I don't know if people really understand that these terrible tax laws are going to force people into selling their farms or selling a lot of their farms off just to pay the tax. It's just, I guess people just don't really care. Maybe just more and more corporate farms that that have the money to do that. But
and I think you bring up a good point where I don't think, you know, people in Congress are saying, hey, we're going to do this because it's going to equalize wealth. Well, really what it's going to do is drive more and more of farming into consolidation. And now part of that is going to be there whether we have tax laws or not. Let's be honest, that's not going to change. But, you know, it is much tougher because we hear from the politicians, they want to keep, you know, the farm in the family. But then on the other side, they're imposing these rules that make it less likely that you're going to keep the farm in the family.
Exactly. And I mean, do our citizens really want that? Do they want to see these family farms go away? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we need to make a better case for that and have a platform that we can get that message out. But I mean, I don't know how much the citizens have influence on legislators anyway, but it's really scary here, and we're seeing land values are crazy.
Yep.
We've got a lot of California money coming up here, investing in farmland, buying farms at top dollar, and it makes it difficult for the existing farmers to expand. There's been a lot of development, especially here in the Hillsborough area. I mean, I can't complain too much because we've sold some land by the square foot, which has helped me do these buyouts. But it makes it very difficult for people that want to continue farming to do that. So
Well, we're coming to the end of the podcast, and I always end with two questions. And so my first question is what keeps you up at night? Is there something that, you know, every once in a while you wake up and you go, oh man, I got to deal with this. Is there something that keeps you up at night?
Less and less, I would say. I guess it used to be cash flow.
Yeah.
But this year it went from, oh my gosh, how am I going to pay my bills to, I think I'm going to make it to, I think I'm going to have a pretty good year. So Right. Currently, that's doing okay. I guess just probably more the structure of our farm. We're kind of spread out, getting all our employees on the same page. And I just feel like I can manage the employees better than I've been doing. That's probably the one that keeps me up at night, because I'm mostly in the office. And yep. I really feel like I need to be out in the field more and really connecting with the employees, which I do this time of year. I try to make it down there once a week, but it's been a little difficult here recently. So
yeah, life happens, you know, that for sure. And then my last question is, you know, just what is your definition of success in farming?
Well, I guess I don't know if I can just come up with a sentence on that, but to me personally, being successful in farming, well, number one is making money.
Yeah.
And being able to compensate my employees well, because I couldn't do anything that I do without my employees.
Yep.
And I personally like to give back and help other farmers. And I'm quite involved in the industry, really trying to make our industry better. So I think, to me, that defines success when I can give back in a positive way to the industries that impact us. So that's,
perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yep. No, that's a good definition. And, you know, what I've, you know, I think this is my close to coming up on 30th podcast I've done, and almost all of them, not all, because some are like with politicians and so on. You know, that's been a sort of a common theme. Hey, we need to make money. We need to be able to provide for both our employees and our family, and we need to be able to give back. So I think those are all very good common themes. So, well, Becky, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to have the podcast. And maybe in another year or so, I'll reach out to you and we'll do another podcast, see where you're at that point in time.
Well, Paul, it's always a pleasure to visit with you, and I consider it an honor that you even thought to give me a call. So I appreciate it.
No, honor on my end to have a conversation with you. So that's great. Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.